Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times for January 12th, 2025, the cover story, Do Our Dogs Have Something to Tell the World? Many owners think so thanks to the talking buttons craze on TikTok and Instagram. Scientists are less convinced. And then, he dialed 911 to save his baby. Then his children were taken away. But first, do our dogs have something to tell the world? This article was written by Camille Bromley. As soon as I got Ellie, my black-eyed, bat-eared German Shepherd puppy, I trained her to be a good dog. And so she was. When I spoke, she listened. She kept her barks quiet and her teeth clean. 2 years on, I started to think she was a little too obedient. There was something pitiful about the way that, even unleashed in the park, she would stop at a fork in the path and look to me to point the way. In the house, she would pause behind a half-closed door instead of pushing through. She was hesitant, whining when she was unsure of herself, in a way that clashed with her big muscles and pointy canines. One day, when the cat in our local bodega poked its head out of the store, Ellie squealed like a child. Her training, I saw, had come at the cost of something precious. Her independence, certainly. But also something more intrinsic, something like her animality. Ellie's dad, my partner Jesse, agreed. "I think she needs more self-confidence," he said. The solution, maybe, was buttons. Around this time, I started to see dogs on social media seeming to express their desires by the most absurdly simple, low-tech means possible, stepping on multicolored plastic buttons on the floor, each disc emitting a word when the dog pressed it. I scrolled through videos on my phone of dogs pawing food, and more, and now, sometimes in that order. The most famous was Bunny, a lanky sheepadoodle in Tacoma, Washington, with 8.6 million TikTok followers, a vocabulary of 105 buttons, and a diagnosis of generalized anxiety disorder. Bunny's online store sold a starter pack of 6 buttons for $65. Through the buttons, Bunny reported her experience of the world. She said, "Look, cat." She was frequently concerned. She seemed to have restless dreams about a stranger animal. A favorite topic of conversation was poop, as in poop play. Bunny was advanced in her use of the buttons, a star student. But there was also an endless video stream of other dogs, also cats, pigs, horses, and cows, making equally clever and entertaining statements. I would open the apps and see a mini Aussie doodle with a taste for dirt demanding to go outside for a snack. A French cat being denied a treat and complaining with apparent disdain, paw content. These pets weren't just standing by to serve their human owners. They were companions with voices of their own. I looked over at Ellie, lying in the far corner of the room. Her eyes were dark, her feelings mysterious. What was buried inside that impenetrable dog skull? If I could teach her to use these buttons, she would tell me. Or so I imagined. Ellie's first word, I decided, would be outside. Outside was one of the recommended first words in the informal pedagogy of dog button learning, created by a speech-language pathologist named Christina Hunger. In 2018, when Hunger was raising her blue heeler Catahoula puppy Stella, she noticed that Stella was progressing through the early stages of communication, much as the young toddlers she worked with did. Hunger taught children to speak by tapping icons on a tablet. She wondered, could Stella learn words through a similar method? To test this hypothesis, Hunger bought a set of recordable buttons that, when pressed, would play back her voice saying simple words. outside, water, play, and fastened them to a board on the floor. Every time she talked to Stella, she pressed the corresponding button. About a month later, Stella caught on pressing outside to use the bathroom in the yard, and play to request playtime. After a few months, she pressed water when Christina was watering plants. Stella was narrating what she saw, Hunger thought. Hunger expanded Stella's board, adding emotions like mad and social words like bye. When Stella started putting multiple words together, Hunger wasn't too surprised. Dogs are about as smart as a 2.5-year-old human, and Hunger knew that toddlers at that age typically compose sentences of 2 or 3 words. After a year, Stella was saying bed later and want outside now. One day, the end of daylight saving time delayed Stella's mealtime. She asked for food, and Hunger told her to wait. In protest, she stomped over to her buttons and pressed, love you, no. Hunger's blog of Stella's progress went viral, and other dog owners started experimenting with the buttons. Those accounts themselves went viral. A movement grew. The dogs who used the buttons had some things in common. First, their owners spent a lot of time with them, talking to them, looking at them, pressing buttons with them. Second, these owners were often women with no children in the house. As for the dogs themselves, many had bossy personalities. They had things they needed you to know. A pit bull named Tilda pressed sound twice every time her owner joined a weekly game of Dungeons and Dragons. Should I wear headphones? The owner wondered. A golden retriever named Cash pressed worried when his owner turned on the stove to cook dinner because he wasn't a fan of all the sizzling and popping. When we actually can hear firsthand how an animal is experiencing the world, it profoundly changes how we treat them and how we view them, Hunger told me. Both my husband and I really view Stella as an equal part of our family. Her opinion matters. Her feelings matter. Her thoughts matter. Of all the dogs I saw online, Bunny, the sheepadoodle, had the strongest opinions and the biggest feelings. She hated feet. She hated water. She hated birds. She was known for her outspoken nature and philosophical musings. I dog, she remarked. Dog, why? Scrolling through her videos, I paused on an exchange between Bunny and her owner, Alexis Divine. Mad, Bunny said and looked at Divine. Why are you mad? Divine asked. Ouch, Bunny said. Where is your ouch? Divine asked. Bunny pressed stranger and pawed the side of her head. In your ear? Divine asked. Where's stranger? Bunny appeared to reflect. Paw, she said, and came over to Divine. She held out her shaggy left paw, and the video cut to Divine holding a foxtail thorn that she explains was stuck between her toes. Now, people online are unkind. Bunny's posts incite fervent ridicule as much as they inspire and amaze. Detractors accuse the videos of being faked, selectively edited, cherry-picked. The more scientifically minded skeptics bring up clever Hans, the horse, whose owner toured Germany at the turn of the 20th century to prove he could do mathematical calculations and ended up showing that animals can be very good at picking up on unconscious cues. Everyone knows that while dogs recognize human words, they are not supposed to be able to use words themselves. But for the pet owners, pressing buttons with dogs is not so different from communicating with a small child. As Divine says, what's not to believe? Since at least the Victorian age, when we first began inviting birds, cats, and dogs into our homes en masse to live alongside us, people have endeavored to talk to their pets. Charles Darwin, a lifelong dog owner, drew on observations of his own dogs to develop some of his ideas about the natural world. Darwin was modern science's first great believer in animal minds. He thought that animals, especially primates and some other mammals, had many of the same emotions and mental abilities as humans, only to a different degree. Primates, he wrote in The Descent of Man, feel jealousy, suspicion, emulation, gratitude, and magnanimity. They practice deceit and are revengeful. They are sometimes susceptible to ridicule and even have a sense of humor. Darwin's ideas inspired many Victorians to wonder whether their pets might be taught human languages and vice versa, setting off a long period of preposterous at-home experiments. Darwin's neighbor, John Lubbock, was among the first Victorian naturalists to perform language experiments on an animal. He taught a terrier puppy named Vaughn how to associate cards imprinted with words like bone or tea with the objects they named. To ask for a bone, Vaughn would select the card and bring it to Lubbock in his mouth. Around the time of Lubbock's experiments with Vaughn, a New York publisher produced a phonetic dictionary of some 600 cat sounds compiled by a Frenchman named Alphonse Léon Grimaldi. The transcriptions included everyday vocabulary, lait for milk, plibl for mouse meat, meow for hear, as well as complex concepts like Zuluam for millionaire. In India, meanwhile, the explorer and writer Sir Richard Burton brought 40 monkeys of various species into his house and gave each a name, including one he referred to as his wife, who wore pearl earrings and dined at his side in a high chair. Burton recorded about 60 monkey sounds that he claimed to be able to understand and speak. In London, a 20-year-old Alexander Graham Bell tried out some of his lifelong language experiments on the family terrier, Trove. He would shape Trove's lips with his hands while prompting her to growl, producing sentences like, "How are you, Grandmama?" By the 1960s, researchers understood how naively anthropomorphic those Victorian exercises had been, but communication experiments with animals still promised to settle a great linguistic debate. Did language belong to humans alone, or did non-humans also have some capacity for it? As a challenge to Noam Chomsky's assertion that such a thing was impossible, a baby chimp was christened Nim Chimpsky and sent to live with a human family in Manhattan to learn sign language. Novel and ambitious experiments with primates, dolphins, and parrots proliferated, many of them documenting animals following specific cues and using words and phrases to communicate with their human trainers. Some of these studies had serious flaws in their methodology, however, and in many cases their treatment of the animals would be considered unethical today. Project NIM, the flagship study of this era, enlisted a rotating cast of student volunteers to train NIM in American Sign Language, all while young NIM was disruptively shuttled among homes and caregivers. Eventually, the lapses in these studies began to overshadow the findings. In 1980, a New York Academy of Science conference was held with the mocking purpose of declaring animal language endeavors a failure and the scientists frauds. The excitement and funding flamed out as spectacularly as it began. Nim finished his life in a cage at an animal refuge. Animal language studies acquired an unshakable odor of malfeasance and scientific malpractice. In 2019, Federico Rosano, an associate professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego, got an email from a colleague suggesting someone they might invite to give a talk to the department. In it was a news article about Christina Hunger and Stella. "Mixed feelings about this," Rosano replied, attaching a book chapter he used in his classes titled, "What Did We Learn from the Ape Language Studies?" The answer? Not a lot. But by the following summer, the pandemic had halted Rossano's research on how chimps communicate to share food and how human children make requests. Leo Trottier, a former cognitive science PhD student at UCSD who left the program to found a company that makes game consoles for dogs and recently started the Fluent Pet recordable button brand with Divine, reached out to pitch a study about the buttons. He said he knew of more than 1,000 pet owners who would be willing to participate. Despite his initial hesitation, Rossano saw that this was a unique opportunity to circumvent COVID restrictions and conduct a citizen science study from the participants' homes. Because the study would not rely on a single animal trained by researchers in a lab, but rather on thousands of animals living their normal lives, it was less likely to suffer from the problems and ethical lapses that afflicted past animal language studies. The field of animal behavior, also known as ethology, had itself transformed since 1980, when the term animal cognition was barely used. It is now known that primates, despite being our closest genetic relatives, are not at all that good at understanding humans, while dogs and cats get us more easily. Research suggests that dogs, which have co-evolved with humans over the past 18,000 to 32,000 years, might in fact be the ideal species with which to study two-way communication. They were the first domesticated animals and very likely the first that listened to us talk. When dogs hear human speech, their brains light up with interest. They look where we point. They recognize our facial expressions. They mirror our anxiety. In the buttons, Rossano saw an opportunity to learn what else they could do. But he was cautious. "I did not want to destroy my academic career, to be very honest," he told me. The study that Rossano and his team began in 2020 is the largest animal communication study ever tried, with 10,000 dogs and cats in almost 50 countries around the world. It has proved hugely popular with the public, and much less so with other scientists. When I talked with Rossano in July, he had a beleaguered air. His second paper on the buttons was about to come out, but the path to publication had been slow and onerous. For the past 2 years, his papers were consistently rejected or not even considered for review. It felt like gatekeeping. Earlier that day, another scientist asked him, "Are you the person responsible for my wife wasting my time with clips of dogs?" He was looking forward to going dark for 3 weeks in Kenya, where he would follow a troop of about 150 baboons on foot across the savanna to observe their collective decision-making. Rossano reminded me that he had started at a place of skepticism. "I definitely have a lot of issues with the social media part of this thing," he said, "but there are right now several thousand people who are doing this to their pets, and I think we should try to take it seriously. Is this good? Is it bad? What would it tell us about these animals' minds?" The data that Rossano collected is entirely independent of any social media posts. "I don't even have TikTok," he told me. He screens for the clever Hans effect by using double-blind testing and controls for unintentional cherry-picking on the part of pet owners by setting up cameras running 24/7 in some homes and sending in his own researchers into other homes a few times a year. He has found that the dogs, on average, recognize certain common words and press certain two-word phrases non-randomly, without only mimicking their owner's presses. This indicates that the dogs aren't just mindlessly slamming buttons. But the tests do not yet show that dogs are doing anything scientists didn't already know they could do. More than a decade ago, studies with two border collies named Rico and Chaser demonstrated that some dogs can learn a remarkable number of words, more than 1,000 in the case of Chaser, who also understood semantic instructions like, to ball take frisbee. Hungarian studies involving so-called gifted word learner dogs have found a few dozen dogs from around the world who can learn the names of hundreds of objects even without training and can remember these words years later. These are remarkable feats of cognition, but they mostly rely on the familiar mechanisms of associative learning, first established a century ago by scientists like Ivan Pavlov. Press a button, get a reward. The primary claim of the button users, that dogs are producing original combinations of buttons they haven't been trained to press to communicate something they couldn't otherwise say, is entirely different. When a dog named Parker on TikTok sees an ambulance and presses squeaker than car, she appears to be using words in a way that's closer to how humans do. Multi-word phrases like Parker's are creative, spontaneous, and flexible expressions of language, a quality that the linguist Charles Hockett calls productivity. Productivity is thought to be unique to human language. It's what the most famous animal language studies appeared to show non-human minds were capable of, anecdotally documenting, for example, that Washoe, a chimp, signed Waterbird to refer to a swan, that Coco the gorilla signed finger bracelet to mean a ring, and that the orangutan Chantek called himself orangutan person to differentiate himself from ordinary non-signing orangutans. Herbert Terrace, who led the NIM study, is now a critic of such anecdotes. His latest book is titled Why Chimpanzees Can't Learn Language and Only Humans Can. He maintains that the animals in these studies were merely signing things in random sequence in the hopes of a reward. None of the animals got anywhere close to full grammatical sentences. The longest sequence NIM ever signed after years of confinement and training was give orange me, give eat orange me, eat orange, give me eat orange, give me you. That, Terrace said, is not language. But not all scientists share Terrace's skepticism. We don't know if it's real, we don't know if it's stupid unless we test it, says Irene Pepperberg, a research professor at Boston University. Pepperberg, now sometimes called the mother of avian cognition, is well known in the field for her 30-year long communication study with Alex, an African gray parrot. Pepperberg demonstrated that Alex asked questions, performed simple addition, and, in a few instances, coined neologisms. Partly because of Pepperberg's work, parrots are now widely recognized to have an intelligence roughly comparable to that of a 5-year-old human child. Of Rosano's study, she said, I'd like to see data. I'd like to see what the animals are capable of. All these studies that we're doing in terms of looking at other animals' abilities, it's opening up a world to us. Rosano's next research questions will look at multiple word phrases, the ability to talk about things that aren't present, and emotions. He plans to take biometric measurements to determine whether a dog is physiologically calm when it presses, happy, and stressed when it presses worried. When it presses ball, does it mean one specific ball or any object in the abstract category of spherical toys? In the distant future, he imagines the possibility of testing episodic memory. Does your dog remember the time you took them camping? Rosano's most advanced inquiries will rely on the top performing dogs in his study, the genius dogs, dogs like Bunny and Parker. Most dogs, like most humans, are just mediocre. Out of 10,000 dogs, Rosano estimates about 65 use more than 100 buttons. The median is 9. Ellie was turning out to be an average dog button-wise. Her technique was basic but effective. In the afternoon, she would rouse herself from a nap and smash play over and over until I got up from my computer. She went through a period of insisting on more food after dinner. I assumed she was being greedy until I finally weighed her and found she'd lost 6 pounds. We moved apartments and she started pressing outside, a button she rarely used before. I realized she wanted to sit on the stoop, a feature of our new place. During a thunderstorm late one night, Ellie got up, nervously whining, and paced the living room. She pressed each button in turn, again and again, unleashing a chaotic babble of tinny button words. She was frantically trying to tell us what. It was intolerable. Jesse got up and threw the buttons under the table. Rossano sent me a list of his colleagues in dog cognition research and where they fell on a spectrum from thinks we are okay to hates buttons. On the hates buttons end is Alexandra Horowitz, the head of a dog cognition lab at Barnard College and probably the most publicly known scientific voice on the subject of dogs. In the first chaotic weeks after adopting Ellie, I read her best-selling book, Inside of a Dog, in which she warns against assumptions like thinking your dog's kisses mean he loves you. I called Horowitz and described my experiments with Ellie. To me, that's not great, Horowitz said. Dogs already do so much to accommodate our lives. They're on our schedule. They have to ask us if they want to urinate. They socialize on our schedule. They walk where we want to walk on a leash. Ostensibly, the interest in having dogs is that they're another species. There's something unknown about them, and that's wonderful. Why do we lean into forcing them to wear clothes and speak our language? I told Horowitz that Cash, the golden retriever, repeatedly pressed backyard water until his owner figured out that he might be asking to swim in the river behind the house. When Cash was let outside, he ran right to the water. It's not scientific, Horowitz said. It's possible, she went on, that the dog was requesting to swim. Equally possible, though, was that the dog pressed some buttons and then, unrelatedly, was happy to swim. Neither possibility could be proved false. If the buttons said Rocket Moon and the dog pushed Rocket Moon, most people would say, No, no, that's insane. My dog is not wishing they could take a rocket to the moon, Horowitz said. Within the dog button community, Horowitz is regarded as a killjoy. Another dog researcher in the same camp is Clive Wynn, a behavioral scientist at Arizona State University. Wynn's theory about why dogs occasionally seem to express complex and creative phrases is that they get the most enthusiastic reception from their owners when they press a lot of different buttons, and that the owners pay attention only when these sequences make sense. As a gesture of goodwill, Divine sent Wynn a button as a gift for his dog. Wynn recorded, My name is Zaphos, into the button, and he taught Zaphos to press it. So she said with my voice, My name is Zaphos, Wynn told me. She enjoyed it, and we enjoyed it. I think it's all good, clean fun, but I don't think we learn anything about dogs by doing it. For Wynn, the buttons are not only entirely superfluous to the communication humans and dogs already have, but also potentially a distraction from their natural barks and howls, their tail wags and tucks. I actually think that having dogs press buttons runs the risk of obscuring dogs' voices in the sense of dogs' expressions of themselves, Wynn said. Rossano disagrees with this notion. It doesn't mean that they lose their first language, he said. They're still dogs. They still do their thing, and they still bark at people, and they still scratch the door, and they still try to get toys. It's just that, in addition, they have another way to communicate, and sometimes they choose that way to communicate, which I think is interesting to study. Pet owners will tell you that their dogs love them unrequitedly, that they feel guilty, that they make jokes. According to the science, though, dogs don't necessarily do any of these things. They may whine when you leave the house, but separation anxiety isn't the same as missing you. They can tell when a human is sad, but scientifically speaking, that doesn't mean they care. What's undeniable, though, is the emotional connection that humans feel with our pets. Maybe our language-loving brain needs that bond to manifest in words in order to feel real. Julian Kaminsky, a comparative psychologist who led the RICO study, shared one of her more recent findings with me. Dogs have a muscle around their eyes for the sole purpose of making big, sad puppy dog faces. Wolves do not have this muscle. This eyebrow movement most likely has no meaning for the dogs, Kaminsky told me, but it may have meaning for humans. It makes us want to take care of the poor things. When humans and dogs look each other in the eye, each species produces oxytocin, the same hormone that bonds mothers to their children. Kaminsky believes that dogs have evolved into creatures we treat like our own children and that the buttons feed into this impulse. It's this trap we are falling into, she said. We evolutionarily created this niche for infants that we now have designed this other species to fit right into. People can't help themselves. They see the dog pressing the I love you button and they're like, we're having a conversation. In August, I drove up an unpaved road about 3 hours east of Tacoma to visit Alexis Devine and Bunny. Devine and Leo Trottier have sold more than 2 million buttons. Earlier this year, she moved into a stylish two-story cabin on a 55-acre property to give her dogs a life with more agency. It was fire season, and the hills around the cabin were covered in parched yellow brush. An elk moved on the opposite slope. Mount Rainier, wreathed in snow, loomed in the distance. As soon as I parked, Otter and Tenrek, Devine's second and third dogs, bounded to the car. Devine kept Bunny on a leash, hanging back at a safe distance. Since moving to the cabin, Bunny's chronic anxiety and gastrointestinal issues had calmed. She was less fearful. Upon seeing wildfire smoke around the cabin earlier that year, she pressed fire, but not concerned. Her temper was better. She'd been playing with Otter rather than going ugh about him. About Tenrek, a tiny papillon who looked less like a dog than some kind of plushy gremlin, she was mostly confused. She thinks he's a cat. She said that several times, Devine said. Devine got Bunny as an 8-week-old puppy. I wanted a different complexity of relationship you can only get with a dog, she said. She chose a sheepadoodle because she wanted a smart and active dog, one that could offer a real connection. At the time, she had a successful career as a wearable art designer. When the pandemic began, her fashion shows were canceled. More time for Bunny. She was my next big project, Devine said. I knew before I brought her home that I wanted to teach her to talk. Devine spent those months making jewelry at the coffee table in her living room, Bunny and the buttons spread out right in front of her. She demonstrated the buttons constantly to her new puppy, and Bunny pressed the buttons spontaneously all day long. There was this need for her to feel like she had some control over her environment, Devine said, and I believe that the buttons were a way for her to do that. She could ask me what was going on outside. She could hear a sound and then express an emotion about it. She could request specific places she wanted to go. This is all hindsight, but she was telling me all along how I could help her be in a better frame of mind. The first words, outside, ball, mom, dad, were easy. As Bunny's vocabulary grew, Devine modeled more abstract concepts like yesterday by narrating that Bunny had, the previous day, go see friend. A months-long period when Devine was getting tattoos done was an opportunity for mom, ouch. Bunny picked it up easily. One day she pressed ouch, ouch, ear help, and Devine understood that she had an earache and fleshed her ear with medication. Through her social accounts, Devine met other dog owners teaching their dogs to use buttons, and a couple dozen now gather in person every year. Bunny had changed Devine's life entirely. Devine picked up a new career and moved house. She got an autism diagnosis. She started to question the entire logic of pet ownership. It's just not cool, man, that we have these captive animals, Devine said. Like, it's weird. Animal ownership is a very strange thing to me now. In our conversations, Divine didn't evangelize for the buttons. She believed that they were a good way to understand her dogs and that they allowed her dogs to advocate for themselves. My overarching goal is for that dynamic to exist with or without buttons, she said. In the past several months, Bunny had been using the buttons less, Divine said. She was more relaxed, less needy. She didn't need to speak out so much. Whether or not Bunny was a genius dog, she carried a remarkable presence. Her shaggy head followed me around the cabin. Her eyes were a soulful, piercing hazel that seemed to see me exactly. Her enormous paws flopped around when she walked. She sat next to me on the floor of the cabin watching while I drank a seltzer. I asked if I could talk to Bunny with the buttons. We went over to the board and Alexis stood by the buttons. Bunny sat and looked up at her expectantly. Divine switched into a button voice that I recognized from her videos. "You want talk?" she said to Bunny. "You want talk, friend?" "Hi, Bunny," I pressed and waited as Tenrek trampled the mat, releasing a cascade of words. "Bunny, you want talk, new friend?" Divine said. "You want talk?" she pressed. "Want talk, hmm?" in emphatic staccato. Bunny looked at her. "What do you want to say? Do you want to say hi?" Pause. "New friend love you," she pressed. "Friend." Pause. "Do you want to talk?" Bunny pawed at Divine. "Yes," Bunny pressed. "Yes, what?" Divine said. "Hi, Bunny," I pressed. "I, friend." "How about small talk?" Divine said. She pressed small talk. "Remember when I said friend come later? Now friend is here." Bunny seemed to recognize something was expected of her. She pawed at Divine. "Bubba, I know it's hard, but could you use your words for a moment, please?" Divine said. Bunny came over and licked my face. We tried some more, but Bunny didn't want to talk to me. She just wanted to nap. I didn't mind. The cabin was peaceful with the late afternoon sun streaming in through the windows. It was more pleasant to sit there with a dog in the loose quiet without buttons going off. I sat with Bunny while she dozed and threw a ball for a bit with Otter and Tenrek. When I got in the car to leave, the three dogs lined up on the porch and watched me drive off. The next day, I got a message from Divine. "This morning we were talking about you," Divine wrote, and Bunny said, "Bye, stranger friend." Camille Bromley, who wrote this article, is a writer and editor who has worked at Wired, The Believer, and Harper's. And now I just want to take a brief moment to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now our next article. He dialed 911 to save his baby, then his children were taken away. The controversial medical diagnosis of shaken baby syndrome can send parents to jail. What if the symptoms are caused by something else? This article was written by Pamela Koloff. Nick, who was on paternity leave from his IT job, was caring for his two boys while his wife, Felicia, was at a doctor's appointment. Not long before he called 911 on September 7, 2023, his baby, Arlo, vomited while being given a bottle. Nick, who was cradling him, turned him over to ensure that he did not choke, then changed him into fresh clothes and put him in his bouncy seat. Suddenly, Arlo's eyes rolled back and his body stiffened. Then he went still. Paramedics rushed to the Flannery's home in Blue Ash, Ohio, a suburb of Cincinnati. They revived the infant, but his breathing remained shallow. Felicia, who returned home to find emergency medical workers swarming her driveway, staggered across the front yard toward her family, uncomprehending. In the emergency room at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, the Flannerys looked on as doctors worked to save their son. Soon a social worker took them aside. She explained that a CT scan revealed the presence of subdural hematomas, or bleeding between the brain and the skull, a symptom she said commonly seen in abuse cases. Nick and Felicia were dumbfounded. More tests still needed to be run, she told the Flannerys, but mandatory reporting laws required that the police and child welfare officials be alerted. Nick and Felicia, upset but certain that any concerns would be allayed once doctors gathered more information, said they understood. Detectives arrived and the attending physician told them that subdural hematomas could indicate that there is an underlying medical condition or that the baby had been shaken. It was the second scenario that Felicia remembers the doctor mentioning to her that evening. I'll never forget him telling me. You would probably know this as shaken baby syndrome, she says. Felicia, having once listened to a podcast that characterized the diagnosis as controversial, grew alarmed. No outward sign suggested that Arlo had endured harm. Arlo is a nickname his parents asked that I used to protect his privacy. He had no bruises, scratches, or cuts, no external evidence of head trauma, like a scalp injury or a skull fracture, no broken bones, no symptoms of neglect or malnutrition. Nick and Felicia were his sole caregivers, and neither of them had any previous interaction with Child Protective Services or a criminal history. The next day, as they sat at their son's bedside in the pediatric ICU, they were visited by two doctors with the hospital's child abuse team, Dr. Stephen Pham, who was halfway through a 3-year fellowship in child abuse pediatrics, and Dr. Pratima Shanbhag, a child abuse pediatrician, each examined Arlo. Child abuse pediatrics is a relatively new subspecialty whose practitioners work closely with police officers and social workers to investigate potential cases of intentional harm. These physicians are entrusted with a profound responsibility, deciding whether a child's symptoms indicate abuse or are due to an unrelated medical issue. Their findings often determine whether parents face criminal charges and whether children are separated from their families. Pham asked the Flannerys whether anything had happened to their son, a fall, a car accident, that might account for the bleeding on his brain. More tests still needed to be performed, he said, but the absence of any reasonable explanation for Arlo's symptoms suggested that the infant had suffered abusive head trauma. Pham was using the term that the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended physicians employ since 2009 instead of shaken baby syndrome. That year, the AAP endorsed the use of the more comprehensive term abusive head trauma to describe not only brain, skull, and spinal injuries that result from shaking, but also those resulting from blunt impact or a combination of the two. The name change came amid controversy over whether shaken baby syndrome signature symptoms, brain swelling and bleeding around the brain and from the retina, were always evidence of abuse. Once believed to be proof of shaking, the symptoms had by then been shown to have other causes, including accidental falls, illness, infection, and congenital disorders. The courts took notice, and in 2008, a Wisconsin appeals court held that a shift in mainstream medical opinion raised questions about the diagnosis core assumptions. It was in the wake of the Wisconsin decision that the AAP's Committee on Child Abuse and Neglect, a small group of child abuse specialists, spearheaded the name change. The committee's work came at a time when confidence was eroding in a diagnosis that the child protection community saw as vital to safeguarding children. The new name, abusive head trauma, was not only more precise according to its 2009 consensus statement on the matter, it would also shore up credibility in the courts. Legal challenges to the short term, shaken baby syndrome, can distract from the more important questions of accountability of the perpetrator and the safety of the victim, the statement read. 15 years later, the diagnosis is still shaping criminal prosecutions and child welfare investigations. Child abuse pediatricians say they do rigorous workups to rule out the possibilities of both natural and accidental causes before they settle on the diagnosis. But doctors and the police, prosecutors, and judges who look to them for guidance don't always get it right. 35 people whose convictions rested on the diagnosis are currently listed on the National Registry of Exonerations. Not yet counted is Joshua Burns, whose wrongful conviction was vacated by a Michigan court in November. This year, convictions that hinged on the diagnosis were overturned in California, Kentucky, and Minnesota. In Texas, doubts about the guilt of a death row inmate, Robert Roberson, galvanized a bipartisan group of lawmakers to call for a wholesale reappraisal of the evidence. The legal battle that followed succeeded in postponing his scheduled execution in October. In a similar case in Arkansas, another father, Cody Webb, was acquitted of capital murder. Some judges, meanwhile, have started looking at the diagnosis with more skepticism. Last year, a New Jersey appellate court backed a lower court judge who pronounced the diagnosis akin to junk science. That tension between child abuse pediatricians who stand by their ability to identify abuse from telltale symptoms and a mounting number of criminal cases that point to the fallibility of the diagnosis leaves families like the Flannerys vulnerable. The rebranding of shaken baby syndrome preserved the diagnosis and allowed it to live on with less scrutiny, says Randy Papetti, an Arizona trial attorney and author of the 2018 book, The Forensic Unreliability of the Shaken Baby Syndrome. Shaken baby syndrome is alive and well, but mostly operates under an alias. Nick and Felicia had been together ever since they were juniors in high school in Troy, Ohio. He earnest and mild-mannered, with chunky black glasses that channeled Buddy Holly. She warm and unguarded, with a mane of red hair. They were strivers intent on muscling their way out of what Nick called the bottom end of the lower middle class. He enlisted in the Army to pay for college, serving a combat deployment to Afghanistan, and Felicia worked her way into management at a national retail chain. They were intentional about starting a family, waiting until they were financially secure enough in their late 20s for Felicia to stay at home when they had their first child, Arlo's older brother, in 2021. They built a house in a good school district with room for a big family and painted it a cheerful lavender. The Flannerys did not hire a lawyer when the specter of abuse was first raised by doctors. They remained singularly focused on their infant son, who lay intubated in the pediatric ICU, his tiny body dwarfed by medical machinery. Before his hospitalization, they told his pediatrician how he slept so much that Felicia often had to wake him for feedings. But their pediatrician was not overly concerned. Arlo was meeting all his milestones and appeared to be thriving. 3 days after he arrived at the hospital, he underwent surgery to relieve the excess fluid that had been building up inside his head. Nick and Felicia were relieved to see that he gradually improved with each day that followed. In a report that FAM forwarded to the Blue Ash Police Department a week after the operation, he wrote that Arlo's symptoms, which a recent exam had shown included retinal hemorrhages, raised a concern for abusive head trauma. Further testing, he noted, did not turn up any evidence of a genetic condition or a bleeding disorder that could explain his symptoms. Though it was not a definitive diagnosis, it was enough to set in motion a chain of events that would upend the Flannerys' lives. 2 days later, on September 20, 2023, a social worker went to their home to inform them that Hamilton County Job and Family Services, which oversees child protective services for the area, was filing for temporary custody of their children. Moments later, Blue Ash police detectives served a search warrant, demanding that the Flannerys allow them entry and turn over their phones. Police body cameras captured the Flannerys' anguish. Nick buckled, nearly falling to his knees. Felicia, wide-eyed, stared back at the officers' hardened expressions. What followed was a grinding bureaucratic journey that stripped them of everything they had worked so hard to build. They were forbidden to take Arlo home when he was released after a 2-week stay at the hospital. A court order mandated that he and his brother live with Felicia's aunt. Limited to supervised interactions with their children, Nick and Felicia did everything they could to maintain a sense of normalcy, arriving at the aunt's house each morning before dawn so they could be there when the boys awoke, and caring for them throughout the day until Felicia nursed Arlo to sleep. Barred from spending the night, they returned home each evening to an empty house. Desperate to be a family again and hoping that voluntarily submitting to an extra degree of scrutiny might convince the authorities that they had nothing to hide, the Flannerys had cameras installed in every room of their house. At a hearing in Hamilton County Juvenile Court that October, Magistrate Nicholas Varney offered a tentative path forward. The children could return home, but under strict conditions. Nick and Felicia were barred from being alone with them, and the boys' grandmothers, who had come to court and volunteered to help, agreed to take turns and maintain a constant presence. The threat of losing their children never went away. A caseworker would appear unannounced, entering their home and probing whether the Flannerys had deviated in any way from the court order. Their original caseworker and then her replacement often sought to get Felicia alone, pressing her to accept that her husband was an abuser. "I was not seen as protective of my children because I did not believe that Nick hurt our son," she told me. In a November hearing, a prosecuting attorney put the county's objectives plainly. "We maintain that the Flannery children would be at imminent risk of harm were they to continue to reside in their parents' home today, and were custody not to be granted to Job and Family Services." Then on January 3rd, Blue Ash police detectives made an unannounced visit, arresting Nick on assault and child endangerment charges. Nick, who was handcuffed in front of his older son, was careful not to react. "I knew they wanted to see me as this horrible, violent person with a hairpin trigger," he says. From that moment onward, the Flannerys found themselves in parallel legal battles, one in juvenile court over custody of their children, and another in criminal court where Nick faced prosecution. 2 days after his arrest, when he was set to be released on bond, the Flannerys' caseworker arrived at the house without warning. Though Nick was within his rights to return home, the court had not imposed a no-contact order, the caseworker removed the infant and toddler that afternoon. Felicia hurriedly nursed Arlo before he was taken away. "I was sitting on the stairs just crying and crying," Felicia told me. "My toddler started wiping my tears away, and I remember thinking, I have to get it together because this might be the last time I ever see them." The boys were not placed in foster care as she had been told was a possibility. They went to her aunt, and they were returned home the following week at the direction of the juvenile court. But the knowledge that her children could be taken from her at any moment left her unmoored. Stalked by the fear of what might happen if one of the boys fell or hurt themselves, she rarely left home, trusting the cameras she had installed to document her every interaction with her children. She and Nick scrupulously followed the court's order to have an approved family member present around the clock, but she began losing sleep over any possible breach, even imagined, that could cost them custody. "I started having nightmares," she says, "where the nightmare was that I was found alone with my children." The Flannerys felt certain there was a logical explanation for Arlo's symptoms, and they began to piece together what they knew, starting with his difficult delivery, which had ended in an emergency C-section. More than 24 hours of labor, augmented with Pitocin to make contractions stronger, had left a deep hollow above his forehead. The Flannerys had been assured that this was a normal consequence of a challenging delivery, and the indentation, though conspicuous, had eventually gone away. In retrospect, they wondered if this had anything to do with the bleeding on his brain. Also notable looking back was the drastic increase in Arlo's head circumference in the weeks after his birth. By 1 month, his medical records showed he had leaped from the 81st percentile for the head size to the 99th, which was a possible cause for concern. The Flannerys had been told that his head growth would have to be monitored. If it continued to expand at the same rate, he would be referred to a specialist for evaluation. His next head measurement was scheduled to be taken the day after Nick called 911. As their questions multiplied, the Flannerys consulted three doctors, a pediatrician who was qualified to testify in court as a child abuse expert, a pediatric neurologist, and a radiologist. After studying Arlo's medical records and imaging, they each concluded that he had not suffered a sudden trauma just before he was rushed to the ER. In written reports and in later testimony given in juvenile court by two of the experts, they laid out their findings. Arlo, they determined, had a pre-existing health condition. The bleeding on his brain was chronic, most likely originating at birth. Fluid had then collected between his brain and skull and pressure built, eventually triggering seizures. This explained Arlo's rapid head growth and the excessive sleepiness that the Flannerys had reported to their pediatrician. In his report, Pham dismissed the idea that Arlo's birth was to blame, pointing to the baby's sudden collapse a full 2 months after he was born. Pham made no mention of the details in Arlo's medical records that noted the baby's head circumference at 1 month or the unusual rate of growth that his pediatrician had flagged for further monitoring. But several facts in the medical record suggested an ongoing condition. In addition to his quickly expanding head circumference, there was his pronounced sleepiness, possibly a symptom of seizures related to fluid around the brain. There were also the postoperative notes of Arlo's neurosurgeon, which described the subdural hematomas as chronic, suggesting that they had been present for an indeterminate period of time. The blood on the infant's brain was straw-colored, the surgeon had observed, not the pink or red typically associated with acute trauma. During a 2023 juvenile court hearing, Pham acknowledged speaking with the neurosurgeon and reviewing the surgical notes, but he said he did not include them in his report because he focused on other indicators such as Arlo's rapid decline. "The thing that I focused on is his acute presentation," Pham said. I wanted to better understand Pham's perspective and that of the pediatrician who examined Arlo with him, Schonbach. The Flannerys agreed to provide a letter authorizing the doctors to talk to me about their son's protected health information, but a spokesperson for Cincinnati Children's declined to make them available for an interview. The hospital also did not respond to a detailed list of questions. I'm sorry, but that is all the time we have for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.